He has a more important thing to do, finishing his epic about the matter of Britain that will solve the problem of why humans fight at all. And that is why he has come here to County Mayo and rented Sheskin Lodge to write in, a crumbling aristocratic bungalow with a glassed-in winter garden set amid acres of feral rhododendron and pine. He sits in the torn leather armchair in the room with the peeling walls. The plangent sound of hawk bells drifts through the open window each time the falcons bait from their blocks on the lawn. Cully is dead. She tangled herself in strawberry netting in the cottage barn and hung herself. But he has trained two merlins since, and now he has two peregrines, a bad-tempered falcon called Cressida, and a nervous young tearsel as yet unnamed. For the last half hour, he has been recording the delicate steps of their training in a vellum-bound journal. He pauses. A thought has struck him, borne in with the sound of bells. Perhaps he might write the book about hawks after all. He had tried once and failed. Perhaps he would try again. It would not be the usual naturalist book about hawks. That would be bogus, he thinks. This would be real literature. He begins to sketch out why. The initiation ceremonies, the voodoo hut of the falconer, the noises in the magic dark, the necromantic knots. Knots were probably the earliest spells. The two hawks consider themselves spellbound to their blocks by my arts. I am convinced that if nobody had ever invented knots, nobody would ever have imagined magicians. As a falconer, he would be in the book, along with all the other parts he would play in the hawk's education. First, he will be Torquemada, the Inquisitor. Then, the witch doctor of the ceremonies of puberty, and the terrifying presence that will test them, their devil god of the cave. And then he will be Prospero, of course, the masterly magician who has led them through all the ceremonies and ordeals of their hawkish adolescence. For White thinks he knows what freedom is now and what growing up means. He is party to the magic that is the binding of the hawk to the magician's will, and knows that at the end of the book must come the deepest mystery of all. The hawk must escape. Of course it must, for the hawk would have to unwind the charm, to escape, to cock his snook at the negromant, only to find that there was a charm within the charm, that the wizard was a holy man, after all, quite happy about the escape himself. He finishes the paragraph and finds himself greatly moved. There he would stand, small and inverted, looking up from the scorned earth, his planetarium of a cloak blowing in the wind, his wand outwitted, his white beard streaming. And Folco? A triumph, a hatred, and a gratitude. No logic or moral, only the magic for its own sake, weaving and unwoven. Chapter 28. Winter Histories. There's a complicated sky of cold front ragged cloud under swathes of high cirrostratus, and a headwind that sends larks up like chaff as we walk through the fields. Clouds of linnets bounce, half midges, half musical notation, along the hedges surrounding my old home, and all is out of sorts as far as that notion of home lies, because my father isn't here. It is late winter, and I'm back at my mother's house. Things are better now, I know, and I've been coming here more often, but each time I forget how hard it will be. The winter fields are shorn, yellowed into stalky rabbit-grey sward, spotted with foraging rooks. I can hawk with Mabel all the way across this land, until it ends in a slumpy hedge, so wide it's almost a wood, furrily iced with old man's beard. Beyond it is someone else's land, a terra incognita, holding the suppressed fascination we all have for places just beyond where we know or are supposed to be. I stand at the top of the field, change her jesses, remove her leash, thread the swivel onto it, double back the leash and stuff it deep into my pocket. I hold my arm high, wait for her to look about, and cast her off my fist into the gusty wind. She glides down to the far hedge and swings up into a small ash, shaking her tail. I follow her down, and we start hawking proper, looking for rabbits in a tangle of broken, open woodland. This line of trees is not designed for human thoroughfare. There are elder bushes, green twigs and branches starred with lichen. There are fallen oaks, clumps of vicious brambles, screens of hazel and ivy clambering and covering stumps and extending a hand up to the trees above to scramble into the light. So the whole place is umbrous and decorated with shiny scales of ivy leaves. The air tastes of humus and decay. Each footfall breaks twigs and has that slightly uncertain, oddly hollow quality of walking on thick woodland soil. Mabel is being extraordinary. I've mostly flown her in open country before. She has grasped how woodland hawking works and is hugely attentive. More than attentive. Flying a goshawk in escape of obstacles and broken sightlines makes the connection between us hugely manifest. She breaks through twigs to come down to my fist when I whistle, and she follows me as I walk, moving above me like a personal angel whenever I'm out of sight. I look up and see her crouching, staring at me with round eyes, pupils dilated with excitement and attention, crayon yellow toes gripping dead ash branches. Or floating above me, above the branches, flickering through, sending submarine ripples behind her. There's no narrative to be spoken of. There is the moment when I turn and see the calm, haunting face of a young rabbit looking out of a hole 10 feet away, ears up, nose twitching. A little grey doe. I can't call attention to it. The world triangulates and halts dead. The rabbit and I look at each other. It realizes this stare is an involvement in death and disappears. Mabel doesn't see it until the moment where the rabbit becomes air as it pops back down the hole, but she has to fly anyway to the after image just in case and tears off at low level and brushes the hole with one foot before swinging up high in a tree and shaking her tail, looking down. There is the moment where I'm running blindly after the hawk and see her footing at a branch 40 foot up a sweet chestnut, a failed attack at a grey squirrel, which skitters up the helically coiled saglines of the trunk and away to the safety of a high branch, and bark shards fall around me like delicate waxen snow as Mabel returns on call to my fist, and I'm relieved as hell because squirrels bite. They can take the toe off a hawk's foot. Not that I can blame them given the circumstances. Then the moment where she comes towards me at ground level, because that's the only way through a big bank of elder twigs, and as she comes, I'm watching the way the feathers on her back lift just a little as she stalls to slam into the glove, blam, all 8 toes and talons gripping hard, then relaxing, and she looks right at me in a blaze of expectation. And then, quite suddenly, she sees something through the trees out there on the other side of the hedge. Her pupils grow wide, she snakes her neck and flattens her crown, and the tiny grey hair feathers around her beak and eyes crinkle into a frown that I've learned means there's something there. I decide to investigate, even though I don't have permission to fly her over there. Carefully, so as not to put it anywhere near my trousers, so far I've torn 3 pairs to shreds out hawking, I high-step over the rusty fence wire, turn about, and find myself calf-deep in dead game cover crop, the colour of wet tobacco. We are looking out across a wide, downland valley. It's beautiful. I take one deep breath and exhale, full of the ballooning lightheadedness of standing on chalk. Chalk landscapes do this to me, bring an exhilarating on tiptoe sense that some deep revelation is at hand. This makes me feel guilty. There's a long vein of chalk mysticism buried in English nature culture, and I know that what I'm feeling standing here partakes of it. I'm guilty because I know that loving landscapes like this involves a kind of history that concerns itself with purity, a sense of deep time and blood belonging, and assumes that these solitudinous, windswept landscapes are finer, better than the landscapes below. The frequenter of downland is occupied with essentials, with structure, with forms, and with textures, wrote chalk cult ruralist H.J. Massingham in the 1930s. Aloft, he breathes an air that tunes him to the grand, archaic, naked forms of things. It's a landscape that is a parable of the aviator's eye. I grew up in the lowland pine forests and heaths of Sandy, Surrey. But there's a photograph of me wrapped in a tartan duffel coat, laying a 5-year-old hand on one of the stones at Stonehenge, where my childish brain first grasped at intimations of history. And when I was a little older, corn buntings jangling from high ground fence posts out near Wantage, I remember my father telling me that the track we walked upon, the Ridgeway, was an ancient, ancient path. This impressed me greatly. It was the 1970s, which had seen another great burst of the cult of chalk and history. There were experimental Iron Age reenactment villages at Butser, scary children's TV dramas about the stone circles at Avebury, great busted reintroductions on top-secret military establishments on Salisbury Plain. Now, I wonder why. Was it some response to the oil crisis? To economic depression? I don't know. But up on the Ridgeway Path, age 9 or 10, was where, for the first time, I realized the power a person might feel by aligning themselves to deep history. Only much later did I understand these intimations of history had their own darker history, that the chalk cult rested on a presumption of organic connections to a landscape, a sense of belonging sanctified through an appeal to your own imagined lineage, that chalk downlands held their national as well as natural histories. And it was much later, too, that I realized these myths hurt, that they work to wipe away other cultures, other histories, other ways of loving, working, and being in a landscape, how they tiptoe towards darkness. I'm standing on the far side of my familiar hedge, looking at this terra incognita that is the grand 20th century conjuration of our mythical English past. I walk out of the cover crop to where the thin, stony soil is exposed, so thick with chalk it's like white paste, hair roots and flints spotted with rain, tiny buttons of stone in impasto. The land falls away at my feet into a dry valley, a basin the size of a village, one beech copse hanging grey from its left-hand slope. It is a field of a million tiny tillers, little shoots of wheat. They give the chalky earth a furry tint like algae on a cliff face. Even in this dark, watery light, the valley shines palely, and I see what Mabel has seen. About 100 yards in front of us, crouched in its form, is a big brown hare, black-tipped ears laid to its ginger back. But there's more, much more here. Down at the bottom of the valley, where the river would be were there water, is a herd of 30 fallow deer. They are the colour of moleskin on their backs, shading to pale grey underneath. They're tight-clustered, quivering with indecision. They're watching me, 30 upraised heads. The herd is delicate and powerful, and it is waiting to see what I will do. I can't resist the urge that takes hold of me then. I hold on to Mabel, who's watching them too, and like a woman possessed, walk towards them, with that strange disconnect between head and feet you feel when walking downhill. I'm technically trespassing, but I can't help it. I want to interact with them in some way. I want to get closer. And as I do, the pressure of my impending arrival pushes single deer off to the right, and they walk, then canter, in a long line along the bottom of the valley and up to the wood at the far edge of the field a good half mile away. They are bewitching. Mabel watches them. She is ignoring the hare. The deer in procession resemble charcoal cave paintings rendered manifest, art's magic working backwards, the chalk behind them, bone. And now the hare runs, too. The hare runs in the opposite direction to the deer. The animals run, and the landscape seems then to be parting in front of me, deer one way, hare the other, and now they are quite gone. The hare to the field margin, at the top of the hill to my left, the deer into the wood at the top of the hill to my right. There is nothing before me now but wind and chalk and wheat. Nothing. The hawk rouses again and begins to preen her covert feathers. The running deer and the running hare, legacies of trade and invasion, farming, hunting, settlement. Hares were introduced, it's thought, by the Romans. Fallow deer certainly were. Pheasants, too, brought in their burnished hordes from Asia Minor. The partridges possessing this ground were originally from France, and the ones I see here were hatched in game farm forced-air incubators. The squirrel and the sweet chestnut? North America. Rabbits? Medieval introductions. Felt, meat, fur, feather from all corners, but possessing the ground all the same. We set off again, homeward this time. But now the rain in the air is harder, and the rabbits are so close to their holes that Mabel's not able to get a foot to them before they disappear. After one hairsbreadth miss in a rocky quarry hole by a bank of wild rose stems, I call her back and feed her up. She is tired. Beads of water spot her head and tiny eyelash feathers. We stroll back to the car park. I'm tired too, and glad to see people walking towards us. I've met them before. A retired couple from my mother's village, walking their white muzzled terrier on a long lead. They're all wrapped up with scarves and snap-fastened country jackets, and their shoulders are set a little against the cold and wet. I meet them here quite often. I've always been delighted to see them. I don't know their names, and they don't know mine, though they know my hawk's called Mabel. I wave, and they stop and wave back. "Hello," I say. "Hello, how's the hawk?" they ask. "She's good," I say happily, but tired. "She's been flying all over the place. It's beautiful out here today." "I saw the deer," I went on, glad to have someone to tell. "A big herd of them, dark-coated, down in the bottom of the valley." "Yes," he says. "The deer. Special, aren't they, those ones? Rare. We see them quite often." He is smiling. We're all enjoying our shared secret of a place. She's nodding too. "Aren't they beautiful?" she says. "We counted them once, didn't we?" He nods. "There are usually between 25 and 30. 30 exactly, I say. "They're a lovely sight." I agree. She tucks her scarf more tightly around her as a squall begins. Her husband nods vigorously, rain darkening his shoulders. "A herd of deer," he says, beaming. Then his expression folds into something I don't recognize. "Doesn't it give you hope?" he says suddenly. "Hope?" "Yes," he says. "Isn't it a relief that there are things still like that? A real bit of old England still left, despite all these immigrants coming in." I don't know what to say. His words hang, and All the awkwardness is silence. The leaves rattle in the hazel stems, and I nod a goodbye, sad as hell, and my hawk and I trudge home through the rain. It is a miserable walk. I should have said something, but embarrassment had stopped my tongue. Stomping along, I start pulling on the thread of darkness they'd handed me. I think of the chalk cult countryside and all its myths of blood belonging and that hateful bronze falcon, of Goering's plans to exclude Jews from German forests. I think of the Finnish goshawks that made the Brecklands home, and of my grandfather born on the Western Isles, who spoke nothing but Gaelic until he was 10, and the Lithuanian builder I'd met collecting mushrooms in a wood who asked me, bewildered, why no one he'd met in England knew which were edible and which were not. I think of all the complicated histories that landscapes have and how easy it is to wipe them away, put easier, safer histories in their place. They are only safe for us. The fields where I fly Mabel back in Cambridge are farmed organically, and they are teeming with life. These are not. The big animals are here, it's true, the deer, the foxes, the rabbits. The fields look the same, and the trees too, but look more carefully, and this land is empty. There are few plants other than crops, and few bees or butterflies, for the soil is dressed and sprayed with chemicals that kill. 10 years ago, there were turtle doves on this land. 30 years ago, there were corn buntings and enormous flocks of lapwings. 70 years ago, there were red-backed shrikes, wrynecks and snipe. 200 years ago, ravens and black grouse. All of them are gone. Old England is an imaginary place, a landscape built from words, woodcuts, films, paintings, picturesque engravings. It is a place imagined by people, and people do not live very long or look very hard. We are very bad at scale. The things that live in the soil are too small to care about, climate change too large to imagine. We are bad at time, too. We cannot remember what lived here before we did. We cannot love what is not. Nor can we imagine what will be different when we are dead. We live out our 70 and tie our knots and lines only to ourselves. We take solace in pictures, and we wipe the hills of history. History and life, too. It might resemble Old England here, but it is not anything like the country of 400 years ago, of 100 years ago. I am nearly home now, and I'm sad and angry and fired up as hell. I wish that we would not fight for landscapes that remind us of who we think we are. I wish we would fight instead for landscapes buzzing and glowing with life in all its variousness. And I am guilty, too. I'd wanted to escape history by running to the hawk. Forget the darkness. Forget Goering's hawks. Forget death. Forget all the things that had been before. But my flight was wrong. Worse than wrong. It was dangerous. I must fight always against forgetting, I thought. And I wish I had run after that couple and explained about the deer. I wish I had stood there in the mud in the rain, waving one hand with a hawk on the other, shouting about history and blood. Later that night, I find my father's plane-spotting diaries at the bottom of his bookshelves, 6 hard-backed, cloth-spined exercise books. I pull one out at random. 1956. He was 16. The pages are divided into columns headed with careful inked capitals. Time, number of planes, type of plane, remarks, registration number. I look at the first column. On the 25th of April, he starts watching at 9:40 a.m. and leaves at 7 p.m. On the 26th, he starts at 9 and ends at 9 p.m. 12 hours of looking up at the sky, good God. There are hundreds of pages and thousands upon thousands of aircraft here. Vickers V-70 Viscounts, F-86 Sabres, Airspeed Ambassadors, Lockheed Super Constellations, Gloucester Meteors. Here's his report of a visit to Croydon Airport at the end of May. 8 de Havilland Tiger Moths, 2 Ouster Aiglet Trainers, 2 Taylorcraft Plus Ds, 1 Ouster 5, 3 de Havilland 104 Doves. I have no idea what these planes are. I find a glued-in snapshot of a Tupolev Tu-104. He has written a few lines underneath. This aircraft is undoubtedly a civil conversion of the Type 39 Badger, but the Russians said it was a completely new aircraft. It has all the burning pedantry I remember from my childhood obsession with hawks. Suddenly my father seems very close. Another photograph falls out. I pick it up. De Havilland 104 Dove, Croydon Airport, 2456. I cross-check the registration number against the list. GAMYO, Morton Air Services. The edge of the runway is lost in mist. I can see a tiny profile inside the cockpit, the suggestion of a man leaning forward to wipe the canopy before the plane climbs into the grey April sky. It is then that the knowledge of why my father watched planes drops into my head. When he and his friends had been small boys running feral across London bomb sites, he told me, they collected things, collected anything, shrapnel, cigarette packets, coins, mostly things that came in series, things that could be matched and swapped, sets that could be completed. Collecting things like this, I realized, must have stitched together their broken world of rubble, made sense of a world disordered by war. And my father's aeroplanes were just as much of a set to collect, a series of beautiful, moving things with names and numbers, all deeply concerned with danger and survival. But there was more. Aeroplanes had wings. They took flight. And if you knew them, watched them, understood their movements, you could somehow take flight too. You could watch that Tupolev 104 take off and know it will cross borders you cannot cross except in your imagination. In a few hours, it will be on a snowy Soviet airfield, or any one of a thousand else. In watching the planes, you fly with them and escape. They enlarge your little world and spread it across the seas. The notebooks are full of a fierce attention to things I do not know, but now I know what they are for. These are records of ordered transcendence. A watcher's diary. My father's talk of patience had held within it all the magic that is waiting and looking up at the moving sky. I put the notebook back, and as I do, I see there's a piece of brown cardboard between the next two notebooks on the shelves. Puzzled, I pull it out. It is a blank piece of thick card cut roughly along one edge. I turn it over. My heart misses a beat, because stuck to the other side is a silver door key under 3 inches of clear tape, and 5 words written in pencil. Key to flat. Love, Dad. Dad had posted it to me last year, so I could stay at his flat in London when he was away. I'd lost it, of course. My daughter, the absent-minded professor, he'd said, rolling his eyes. Don't worry, I'll get another one cut. But he'd never got round to it, and I'd not thought of it since. I don't know what it is doing here. I read the words again and think of his hand writing them, and I think of Dad holding my own tiny hand as I put the other one flat against the sarsens at Stonehenge back when I was very small and there were no fences to stop you walking among the stones. I looked up at the thing that was like a door, but had no walls behind it.
Is it a house, Daddy?
I asked him. No one knows, he said. It's very, very old. I held the cardboard and felt its scissor-cut edge. And for the first time, I understood the shape of my grief. I could feel exactly how big it was. It was the strangest feeling, like holding something the size of a mountain in my arms. You have to be patient, he had said. If you want to see something very much, you just have to be patient and wait. There was no patience in my waiting, but time had passed all the same and worked its careful magic. And now, holding the card in my hands and feeling its edges, all the grief had turned into something different. It was simply love. I tucked the card back into the bookshelf. Love you too, Dad, I whispered. Chapter 29. Enter Spring. Mandy opens her door, takes one look at my face, and mirrors it with a horrified expression of her own.
What's happened, Helen?
Mabel, I say weakly.
Did you lose her?
No, shaking my head. She's in the car. And then three requests. Mandy, can you help? I cut my thumb. Can I use your phone? I need a cigarette. Bless her forever. I collapse into a kitchen chair. My knees hurt. Brambles? I have no idea. My thumb is still bleeding. Mandy hands me iodine wash, fixes the tear with Steri-Strips and bandages, makes me a coffee, pushes a packet of tobacco and cigarette papers across the table. Then she waits, while I call the college where I should, right now, be teaching and stammer out apologies. Then I tell my sorry story. I'd seen signs over the last week or so. The season was turning. A blue bottle in the garden. Torpid purple crocuses on the lawn. Dots of cherry blossom falling outside the walls of St. John's. And one evening last week, a host of blackbirds caroling into the deepening sky from perches all over the city's gable ends and Gothic spires. Spring was coming. And usually I'd rejoice at the curious bluish tint to the air and the lengthening days. But spring will mean no more Mabel. She'll be molting in an aviary. I shan't see her for months. My heart hurts thinking of it. So I wasn't thinking of it. I'd ignored the flowers and the flies, and that was part of the problem. For something was stirring in Mabel's excipitrine heart, and perhaps it was spring. I had an hour to fly her today. I had some freelance teaching in town that afternoon, and I knew I was cutting it fine, so I decided to head back to the old field where the rabbits are. We'll catch a rabbit, I thought. Then I'll drop her back at the house, pick up the teaching material, and run down the road to teach it. What could possibly go wrong? Everything. She flies a rabbit, half-heartedly, lights upon a hedge line and looks about. When I call her back, she takes a while to return. The warning signs are there already, but I'm ignoring them. One more flight, I tell myself. But what Mabel is doing is reveling in the weight of the sun on her back, and in the little intimations that warm air is rising into this steady grey-blue sky. She courses another rabbit and sails onward, away from me, pitching high up in chestnut trees, and now I realize she's losing all interest in me. I kick myself. After the last debacle here, I swore I'd be more careful. The trees are above a road. There's an unsettling proximity of moving cars and trucks and tractors. She doesn't want to be here any more. She crosses the road into a belt of trees and graveled drives. I follow her. Rabbits break all around me and the private keep out signs. She ignores them and me. She's taken stand in a tree a good 25 feet above me and looks out at the prospect all around. I'm waving my glove and whistling, but this is a lost cause. She fluffs her tummy and shakes her tail, a goshawk's signs of happiness and contentment. but on an inaccessible branch. With the seconds ticking past, these lovely signs of relaxation and calm bring a sinking feeling. And I realize I failed to bring my telephone, or my cigarettes, and the radio tracking receiver is in the car. After a minute or so, she slips away, out the back of the wood and away into land I know nothing about. It turns out there's a lovely soft field of burnt butter-coloured grasses here and a thick grey wood about 300 yards distant, and no goshawk anywhere. Back to the car I go, unpack the radio telemetry and spend ages tracking her down. The signal is all over the place. Beep, beep, beep. In this direction, the signal strength is 5. Here, 7.5. But then, 2? What? Triangulate. Triangulate. I angle the antenna and spin in circles. Is she moving? She must be. And over the distant wood, I see her on the saw. She's letting the rising air carry her, spilling over the wood in rich circles of sun-warmed flight. Another hawk comes up, and the two slip and rival each other for a while. I run, of course. By the time I reach the wood, there's no sign of either of them, though I hear a buzzard mewing some way off. Then suddenly bells, somewhere in there. I dive into the wood. The signs aren't good. It's not a thick wood. It's not a wild wood. It's a habited wood. It's a pheasant release wood, to be sure. Oh, Lord, this goshawk is making me a criminal again. I spot her. She's poised on a low branch of an ivy-covered oak, staring, fascinated, into a tangle of old feed sacks and bins in an inch of water. I walk closer. She's making those snaky-necked, prospecting parallax movements of her head that means she's locked onto something. She's going to ignore me until she's established to her satisfaction that it's gone. Perhaps it has. I edge my way to where she's looking, and before I know what is happening, a wet cock pheasant breaks from my feet, showering me with water. In slow motion, I see the sun through his primaries splintering into bars and abrupt shadows, and watch Mabel do a smart wing over, and her left foot flash out, but its 2.5-inch back talons and crayon yellow hand just miss him. He rises over, oh horror, I hadn't seen it, a 10-foot chicken wire fence, and buries himself in a huge stand of laurel and yew on the other side. She dives in after him. I can't get to them. They're in a bloody pheasant release pen. Shit. This is like taking a ferret into a fancy rabbit show. Not good. Not good. I can hear wings beating, bells ringing, the sounds of a struggle. I run like a rat around the perimeter of the pen, trying to find a way in. This is not what I had wanted to happen. Oh, God, oh, God. There's a door. It's open. I dump the receiver on a blue feeder bin and run in. She's no longer in the laurel. She's on top of it. She turns away from me, and before I can take another breath, she is off again through the sun-filtered branches, fast and determined. Shit! Shit! I start running over branches, past little corrugated shelters, over earth compacted by hundreds of pheasanty toes. Any minute now, I think, I am going to hear the oi! Of an incredibly angry keeper. Perhaps he will have a shotgun, I think, as I watch Mabel pile into a hen pheasant at the far corner of the pen in a leafy explosion of buff and cappuccino feathers and beating wings. When I get to her, she is sitting in a black puddle of acid woodland water, mantling over the body of a hen pheasant. And as I walk up, another hen pheasant emerges from under her wing, and she grabs that too. She has a pheasant in each foot. Oh my God, carnage! Her tail is spread into the puddle, her feet are buried in feathers, and her whole being seems to be vibrating at some unlikely, scary frequency. The pheasants are dead. One is in my waistcoat pocket. and the other is being plumed by my errant goshawk in lifting puffs of soft contour feathers that float and catch in the wire behind her. We need to get out of here fast before I have explaining to do. Shaking with worry, I take Mabel from her quarry, and then I injure myself horribly. Cutting through pheasant sinew, I take a wide, shallow strip of skin from my thumb. And as soon as I get Mabel back on the glove and stow her illicit prize in my waistcoat pocket, I start to worry about the amount of blood I'm losing. It's not just that my hand is completely red. I can hear the drips falling to the woodland floor. I press the wound hard into the fabric of my hawking jacket. It's covered in germs, I know, but I must stop the bleeding, must stop the blood. And blood pours from me all the long way back to the car and all the way to Stuart's house. I can never go back there, I think. Never, ever again. In March 1949, the publisher Wren Howard of Jonathan Cape travelled to the Channel Islands to stay at White's new home. White had moved to the island of Alderney. It was a perfect refuge from the taxman and the world. He'd bought a white, three-storied house in St. Anne's with magnolia wainscoted walls. He'd filled it with new things, his own surrealist paintings, a boudoir grand piano, silver candlesticks and a statuette of the Emperor Hadrian. There were dark curtains printed with bouquets of ghostly silver roses, jazz records, Jacobean chairs, and a sofa, towards which White ushered Howard to sit. Howard sat. It was wildly uncomfortable. He got up and examined the seat. There was something beneath the cushion. He reached under it and pulled out a thick pile of papers. He asked White what it was. White looked worried. It was the manuscript to a book he had written about hawks, he explained. He did not want it published because after it was written, he became a good falconer, an authority on the subject, and there were things in it that were embarrassing to remember. Besides, the hawk had been lost. Howard leafed through the first few pages and was intrigued. He took it upstairs and read it overnight. In the morning, he insisted on taking it back to London, for he was sure it should be published. White balked at the idea, but as the weeks went by, Howard and his friends persuaded him, and he consented to its publication on one condition, that he could write a postscript explaining how he ought to have trained the hawk in the light of his later experience. When The Goshawk was published in 1951, it was not a bestseller, but it brought an extraordinary number of letters from readers. Some were congratulatory, others strange. One offered White an eagle. Some disliked the book greatly, and one of these letters White never forgot. It touched a very raw nerve. It was from a man who said that he had for 30 years lectured on birds and watched them all his life. How you can talk of love for a bird after subjecting our wonderful predatory birds to such torture is beyond a normal mind, the letter ran. Is there not enough cruelty in the world without adding to it for one's amusement or hobby? This letter put me off food for 3 days, White later confessed, though I answered it with several pages of affection, apology, and explanation. He waited for a reply. When it came, White wrote, the letter writer used the word normal 5 times, concluding with a pronouncement that he did not wish to hear from me again. It seemed polite to leave it at that. I've moved back to the city, to a little rented house in a street near the river, with a small sunny garden that ends in a tangle of briars. Cats stalk the pavement outside. There are pigeons all over the roof, and it's good to be in a house that I can call my own for a while. Today I'm unpacking boxes and stacking books on shelves. 3 boxes down, 5 to go. I open the next box. Inside, on top of the other books, is The Goshawk. Oh, I think, as I pick it up. It is strange to see it again, because I've not thought of White for a while. As I grew happier, his presence receded, his world more and more distant from mine. I look at the scuffed spine, open it, and flip to the very end. I want to read the very last page, where White lists all the things Goss was. A Prussian officer, a tiller, an Egyptian hieroglyph, a winged Assyrian bull, one of the lunatic dukes or cardinals in the Elizabethan plays of Webster. A litany of human things in stone and armour, in marks on pages and dints in sun-baked clay. I peer out of the dusty window at Mabel in the garden. She is bathed and preened, and now she's leaning backwards to the oil gland above her tail, nibbling it gently, then pulling each tail feather through her beak to make it waterproof. I know she is content. The half-closed, happy eye, the rattling of her feathers, these are signs of raw good humour. I cannot know what she is thinking, but she is very alive. I think of White's list of things, and what a strange, sad ending it is. I swear to myself, standing there with the book open in my hand, that I will not ever reduce my hawk to a hieroglyph, a historical figure, or a misremembered villain. Of course I won't. I can't, because she is not human. Of all the lessons I've learned in my months with Mabel, this is the greatest of all, that there is a world of things out there, rocks and trees and stones and grass and all the things that crawl and run and fly. They are all things in themselves, but we make them sensible to us by giving them meanings that shore up our own views of the world. In my time with Mabel, I've learned how you feel more human once you have known, even in your imagination, what it is like to be not. And I have learned, too, the danger that comes in mistaking the wildness we give a thing for the wildness that animates it. Goshawks are things of death and blood and gore, but they are not excuses for atrocities. Their inhumanity is to be treasured, because what they do has nothing to do with us at all. I put White's book on the shelves, make myself a cup of tea. I'm in a contemplative mood. I'd brought the hawk into my world, and then I pretended I lived in hers. Now it feels different. We share our lives happily in all their separation. I look down at my hands. There are scars on them now, thin white lines. One is from her talons. When she'd been fractious with hunger, it feels like a warning made flesh. Another is a blackthorn rip from the time I'd pushed through a hedge to find the hawk I thought I'd lost. And there were other scars too, but they were not visible. They were the ones she'd helped mend, not make. Chapter 30. The Moving Earth. It is the 27th of February, and I'm feeling distinctly wobbly. Tomorrow I'll be driving Mabel to my friend Tony's house. He's a very old friend of mine, a gifted falconer and a deeply generous man. He lives with his family in a little lemon-coloured house in the flatlands of South Suffolk, half an hour from the sea. I'm looking forward to seeing him, but am wobbly all the same, because this will not be a flying visit for Mabel. Tony's giving Mabel a spare aviary for the molting season. Tomorrow, I'll be driving back here and leaving her behind. I have to do it. It's time for her to drop all her feathers one by one and grow new ones. She needs to be fat and full of food to grow her new plumage, so all week I've been giving her as much quail and pheasant as she can eat. She's round as a turkey now, and part of me has been waiting for her to get wild. A fat goshawk is a wild goshawk, say the books. They're wrong. Of course they are. Mabel's less willing to tolerate strangers in this fed-up state, but she's still as tame as a kitten with me. This morning we played throw-and-catch with paper balls, and for the last hour she's been snoozing on my fist while I watch bad TV. "Right, Mabel," I say. "Bedtime." I put her on her perch in the other room, switch off the light and go upstairs to bed. Some things are too terrifying to comprehend. Seconds can pass in disbelief as the world you live in turns into a lie. At just past 1 in the morning, I'm having one of the worst nightmares of my life. My dreams lately have been small and full of light, but in this one, someone, something, for it cannot be human, has taken hold of the end of my bed and is shaking it hard, trying to pitch me to the floor. It is the feeling in the dream that terrifies me most of all. It is not like a nightmare. It is worse. I wake with a start. Something is still shaking my bed. I can see it move, hear it creaking. There is no one in the room. Every inch of my skin crawls with terror. I am shaking and unable to move. The wrongness is indescribable. The fear is falling through 1,000 feet of air. The bed is still shaking, senselessly, violently, horribly, impossibly. Then it stops. For a few seconds I lie there, stricken. I have not been breathing, I realize. I take a vast gulp of shuddering air. The lampshade above me is swinging in circles still, in a flash of understanding. An earthquake. It was an earthquake, here in England. They hardly ever happen here, do they? Was it definitely an earthquake? It must have been. Yes, I still can't quite believe it. I jump out of bed and peer through the curtains. Lights are on in all the houses. People in the street are wandering fearfully in pyjamas. The phone rings and I pick it up. And it is Christina. "Earthquake!" she yells. "Did you feel it?" I swear, she curses. Ordinary words fail us. We mouth obscenities in the cause of reassurance. But they are not enough. When I put the phone down, I cannot calm myself. I put my hands out flat in front of me, palms down. They are still shaking. "Stop freaking out, Helen," I tell myself. "It's okay. Nothing is broken. Everything is fine." But it is not. The earthquake has brought back all those childhood fears of apocalypse, all the expectation that the world would burn and boil. It is a very old, deep terror, and it feels now that it has never gone away. The fabric of the world has torn. I cannot stitch it back together. And then I remember Mabel. I've heard all the stories about animals fleeing from earthquakes. Oh, God, she must be terrified. I race downstairs, 3 steps at a time, burst through the door and turn on the light in her room. She's asleep. She wakes, pulls her head from her mantle feathers, and looks at me with clear eyes. She's surprised to see me. She yawns, showing her pink mouth like a cat's, and its arrowhead tongue with its black tip. Her creamy underparts are draped right down over her feet, so only one lemony toe and one carbon black talon are exposed. Her other foot is drawn high up at her chest. She felt the tremors, and then she went back to sleep, entirely unmoved by the moving earth. The quake brought no panic, no fear, no sense of wrongness to her at all. She's at home in the world. She's here. She ducks her head upside down, pleased to see me, shakes her feathers into a fluffy mop of contentment. And then, as I sit with her, she slowly closes her eyes, tucks her head back into her feathers, and sleeps. She is not a duke, a cardinal, a hieroglyph, or a mythological beast, but right now Mabel is more than a hawk. She feels like a protecting spirit, my little household god. Some things happen only once, twice in a lifetime. The world is full of signs and wonders that come and go, and if you are lucky, you might be alive to see them. I had thought the world was ending, but my hawk had saved me again, and all the terror was gone. She sleeps all the way to Suffolk in my car. Tony's house is tucked behind trees on a road between two fields and lines of hedgerow elms. I pull into the drive, take Mabel onto my glove and walk across the lawn. He comes out to greet me. We walk together to the high, white-walled aviary behind his mews. He unlocks the door and I step through. Her new home is huge. There are bark-covered branches and perches upholstered in astroturf to massage her feet. There is a bath, a chute through which Tony will drop her food, weedy undergrowth, gravel, a nest ledge to lie on, a patch of warming sun. Above the wire mesh roof, the Suffolk sky. "Well, Mabes," I say, unhooding her, "this is your home for the next few months." She looks down at my hand as it pulls each Jess free from her anklets. Now she stands on my fist wearing none at all. She cocks an eye up to the moving clouds, then examines her surroundings. She follows the line of the roof to the corners, peers at the cinder block foundation walls. For a moment, we are back in the darkened room on that first day of our meeting. I remember that moment when the hawk first forgot me, and flinch inwardly at the knowledge that now she will forget me again. "I'll see you after the summer's over," I say, forgetting, remembering. I put my hand out, drag the tips of my fingers down her teardrop-splashed front. The new feathers she will grow will be barred stone grey and white. The tones of earth and ochre will disappear. Her eyes, when I see her next, will be the deep orange of glowing coals. Everything changes. Everything moves. I lift my hand, cast her towards the nearest perch. She flies, lands, shakes her tail, sees a branch above her, and leaps upon it. She's facing away from me. "I'll miss you," I say. No answer can come, and there is nothing to explain. I turn and walk out of the door, leaving the hawk behind. Tony is waiting outside, his eyes crinkled into a smile. "Come inside the house," he says. He knows what I am feeling. And in I go, where the dogs lie flat on the kitchen floor, tails wagging, and the kettle is whistling, and the house is very warm. Postscript. I needed to find out more about White to write this book. So I spent a week in the Harry Ransom Center, the Texas archive where T.H. White's papers and journals are kept. Reading about muddy English winters while sitting in an air-conditioned library was a very strange experience. Outside, vultures soared on tilted wings through 90-degree heat, and grackles hopped on the burning sidewalks. I turned pages, sifted through manuscripts, read through the books he had owned, returned home with stacks of notes and thoughts. But they did not seem enough. There was something else to be done. So one hot July day, I drove across England to Stowe. It's still a school, but its grounds are open to the public. I parked my car in the National Trust car park, paid my entrance fee, clutched a map, and walked up the long lane to the gate. "Turn left for the best views," the man at the sentry box said. I turned right out of sheer contrariness and set off on my quest. The vast Palladian palace bright on the horizon, everything under metallic sunlight that made the lime leaves black and the lake water a deep